ABC News, good afternoon. I'm Zalika Rizmal. There are lengthy traffic delays stretching across inner Melbourne after a serious collision on the Westgate Bridge. A truck and car collided just before 11 o'clock, closing all outbound lanes of the Westgate Freeway. The Department of Transport's Andrew Crook says delays stretch back through the Domain Tunnel and onto the Monash Freeway and around Docklands.
We detoured through the Docklands using Wurundjeri Way, Footscray Road, detour around the north of the city through Carlton, Parkville and Flemington from the southeast, Dandenong Road and Pump Road to head north Toorak Road or even the Eastern Freeway. There's around half an hour delays inbound on the Westgate Freeway also.
The governor of the US state of Illinois says he's furious at gun violence across the country after six people were killed in a shooting north of Chicago. It comes as 22-year-old Robert E. Crimo III was taken into custody following an hours-long manhunt. Police say he opened fire from a rooftop above an Independence Day parade in Highland Park. Governor J.B. Pritzker says it's a tragedy that more innocent lives continue to be taken by gun violence.
I'm furious that this is happening in communities all across Illinois and America. I'm furious because it does not have to be this way. And yet we as a nation, we continue to allow this to happen.
Intense rain is starting to ease across Greater Sydney, but communities further north are now preparing for flash flooding. Jessica Kidd reports.
The weather system is moving north, but major flooding continues in the Georges, Warrenora, Hawkesbury and Nepean rivers. Around 50,000 residents remain under evacuation orders or are on standby to leave. Senior meteorologist Jane Golding says it'll be days before floodwaters recede.
Some locations have seen 800 millimetres over the last 4 days.
Emergency Services Minister Steph Cook says flash flooding is predicted for the Hunter, Central Coast and Mid-North Coast.
Whilst the rain is starting to ease across Sydney, the emergency is far from over.
More than 100 millimetres of rain is expected on the Mid-North Coast and up to 80 millimetres in the Hunter.
Interest rates are expected to increase today for the third time in as many months. Sam Wilkinson reports.
The Reserve Bank Board is meeting today and mortgage holders are preparing for another hike to the official cash rate. It's currently at 0.85% and economists are flagging an increase of half a percentage point to 1.35%. That would be the first time the RBA has ever raised the cash rate by 50 basis points at consecutive meetings. The Reserve Bank is not expected to stop there either. Its governor, Philip Lowe, has previously warned interest rates may have to reach 2.5% as the bank tries to get on top of inflation.
The Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, says the pandemic continues to pose significant challenges as the state records more than 4,000 COVID deaths. The Health Department has confirmed another 8,740 new cases overnight and 16 deaths, taking the state's toll to 4,009. Mr. Andrews says it's a grim milestone.
Any death is obviously a great tragedy for that family, and even just discussing this will be for some a particularly traumatic thing, and it will bring back the burden that they carry with them every single day. So I send my thoughts and prayers and best wishes to every one of those families.
A resident in Melbourne's outer east who lost her home to last year's devastating storms says she's been left with a worthless piece of land after the entire property was declared uninhabitable. Natalie Guest's Kalorama home was one of 76 destroyed by destructive winds in the Dandenong Ranges in June. She says Yarra Ranges Council has just banned anyone from living on the property despite working with the council's consultant on the rebuild.
We would have had the most compliant house in the hills, a lot stronger and a lot safer than the majority of homes. We were following all of the rules. We've got nothing. We've got a woodshed, a skeleton of another shed. We have a new driveway and a water tank. That's it. The trauma of the last 13 months, it's just not on.
Police have identified the person killed in a suspicious factory fire in Ballarat this morning as a 39-year-old man. Firefighters arrived to the factory in Wenderee to find two distressed people saying someone was trapped inside. They found a body in the back corner of the factory. It's believed he'd been living in a caravan inside the building. To the weather now. For the state, partly cloudy with isolated showers on and south of the ranges, dry and mostly sunny elsewhere. For Melbourne, partly cloudy with a top of 15, mostly sunny tomorrow, also 15, Thursday and Friday showers 14. It's 12 degrees in Melbourne now, ABC News.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here. Coming up on the Country Hour, it seems that $10 per kilogram milk solids is going to be fairly common this season, with Buller confirming that's the top price it's offering, and it says that's going to mean price increases on supermarket shelves. And on the theme of supermarket shelves, the price of staple vegetables has gone through the roof, but despite that, a peak horticulture body says farmers are getting ripped off. And shearing and wool handling competitions are finally making a return at the Australian Sheep and Wool Show next weekend. You can text in to the show 0467 842 722 or call in on 1300 594 222. We'll get to rural news shortly, but first up today, an international beekeeper who has been managing varroa mite for more than 15 years is reassuring Australians that the parasite is manageable if it becomes established. Varroa mite has been detected at several sites in New South Wales, and authorities are working to protect the honeybee industry. Varroa mite was first detected in New Zealand more than 20 years ago. And Kiwi beekeeper Darren Webb says Australian beekeepers shouldn't panic because he's confident if the mite spreads, they can learn the skills to control the pest and carry on.
They are very controllable, very manageable, and, you know, all this scaremongering and stuff that's going on in Australia at the moment, it really is getting under my skin because there is no need for it. See, lack of knowledge and lack of experience creates the fear. And knowledge is power.
Mr. Webb first came across varroa mite when he was working as a beekeeper in the USA.
Pretty much as you guys are feeling at the moment, there was apprehension. I was nervous. It was, I guess, fear of the unknown. But there, in the States at the time, there were people that had been dealing with varroa for as long as it had been in the States. So I had some good guidance there with regard to the varroa mites.
Mr. Webb says there's many ways to manage varroa mite, but it's essential to understand your mite load and treat it to help the hive survive. If control methods are needed, Australian authorities will determine what products can be used. While commercial mite strips are available and can be hung inside the beehives, Mr. Webb says he prefers to make his own mixture of oxalic acid and food-grade glycerin, which is combined over heat and then added to strips of cardboard.
I've seen new and prospective beekeepers, or even more experienced beekeepers, they will ask a simple question to a group of beekeepers, and you get about 100 different conflicting answers come back. And then all those beekeepers that gave the answers start fighting and squabbling over who gave the correct answer. Now, in my experience, there is no right way and no wrong way when it comes to beekeeping. As long as it's good for the bees, it's good for you, you're not breaking any laws and you're not creating any public nuisance or bringing harm to anyone or anything around you. So if it's a win-win situation for all parties involved, being the bees and you and everyone and everything around you, that is good beekeeping.
In Australia, there are fears that if varroa mite gets into the feral bee population, then it could decimate the honeybee industry. But Kiwi beekeeper Darren Webb and his wife Mandy dispute this.
You are going to hear all sorts of things about how varroa mite will wipe out the feral bees and all this sort of nonsense. We rescue a lot of bees, feral swarms, yeah, etc. And the feral bees that have been living in a tree for a couple of years or longer, they are the healthiest damn bees we have ever seen.
We did a cutout of a full colony in a wall of a house, been there for 10 years, and they were thriving.
No varroa mites,
nope.
No disease. It's not until you put them into a man-managed beehive that you start to get varroa,
yeah,
and you start to get disease.
The couple says responsible beekeepers have nothing to worry about.
If you are having to deal with varroa mites, it's going to make you a better beekeeper. overall, because you need to be more diligent
and vigilant
and more mindful. And take more notice. It will improve your beekeeping skills overall. So this nonsense about how they're going to destroy the honey industry, and they won't.
You just have to be a better beekeeper and keep on top of it.
Yeah, just add your varroa mite control to your repertoire of beekeeping skills and just carry on.
That was New Zealand beekeepers Darren and Mandy Webb, and they were speaking at a Hive Buddy online forum, which is an experience-sharing platform for beekeepers in Australia. On the text line I mentioned earlier, we'll be talking about shearing and wool handling competitions making a return after a COVID layoff and returning at the Australian Sheep and Wool Show. I think I said next weekend. By next weekend, I meant not this one coming, but the one after that is the date for the Australian Sheep and Wool Show. And a texter just saying the Sheep and Wool Show is from Friday, July 15 to Sunday, July 17. But we will get more about that shearing and wool handling competition shortly. And you can text in 0467 842 722. And we will hear shortly from Jane McNaughton with Rural News. But before that, some dairy news. Buller Dairy Foods has confirmed it's lifted its opening milk price to a range of $9.40 to $10 per kilogram of milk solids. That opening price is $2 per kilogram milk solids, up on the opening price it announced back in March. Rowan Davies, General Manager of Dairy and Procurement at Buller, says there was fierce competition for milk in the lead up to the start of the season.
I think we've seen in the last few weeks it's been very competitive for milk supply here in Australia this year. And so Buller is looking to continue our growth that we've had in recent years, and it's important that we stay very competitive with our milk price. So that led to some of those recent increases that you've seen.
Buller's milk price is now a range of $9.40 to $10 per kilogram milk solid. That's $2 up on the opening range that Buller announced back in March. I think at the time you said that you clearly expected to have to step up from that 740 to 8 range, but did you anticipate you would step up so much?
I think probably the market stayed very strong. That price that we put out in March was a very early price. It was really a baseline price for farmers to plan with, which at that point in time was still quite a strong price versus the cost of production. We always expected that by the time we finish our budgeting and planning and get closer to the start of the season, that it would be quite a large increase. But I think the last few weeks, there's been, as I said before, quite a lot of competition locally. So the prices are probably pushed a little bit higher than we'd anticipated. I think most are probably feeling that at the moment.
And $9.40 to $10, is that enough to attract sufficient supply?
Yes, we've got our milk now planned for the year ahead, so we wanted to make sure that all of our farmers feel like they're getting a very strong price. That's been one of the hallmarks of Buller's supply, a simple pricing arrangement, flat payment, and a very competitive price in the market. So we wanted to make sure that stayed the same way as we start the new season. So we've got the milk we need for the year ahead, albeit it's been a pretty competitive year to get that supply.
So you're not looking for more supply at this stage?
We've got enough to meet our plans. We would welcome any other suppliers that would like to join Buller, so they're welcome to contact us and contact our field officers. We could still take on some more supply as we continue to grow.
There is the prospect that other processors could increase their prices. Do you anticipate that happening, and then would you also need to do the same?
I guess it's possible. There has been a lot of chopping and changing by some processors, so I guess we'll keep an eye on that if something happens to change in the coming weeks and months.
We're talking, I suppose, about your headline range, $9.40 to $10, but a lot of people are on contracts outside of that published range. Does Buller have those special contracts in place?
No, our price is very simple and very transparent. We like to be consistent with the way we work with all of our milk suppliers. So, no, we don't have any of those other sort of deals that you might be talking about. So our price is as you see it.
This is a record price. Buller's an old company, and this would be the most it's ever paid for milk in real dollar terms. What does it mean for the company?
Look, definitely it's a substantial increase in price. I think Buller's, as you said, it's an old company, a family company now that's been around for 112 years, and they've adapted with the market and changes over that time. And this is a big increase, but we're adapting our business to suit, and we're looking forward to the year ahead. It is meaning across for Buller and for others in the industry increases on shelf. So it'll be a very profitable year for farmers, which is great, and hopefully that encourages a lift in production in the coming years. And for consumers, as we're seeing inflation in a lot of categories, we will see some price increases to cover this farm gate price increase.
Can you give any more detail around that, around what someone who buys Buller ice cream, Buller cream, whatever it may be, what price increases they should expect?
Not in detail because it varies by category. I think it's been such a substantial increase at the farm gate that there will be some categories in the dairy cabinets that will see double digit increases, but it does vary across the products.
Given such fierce competition for milk, with quite a lot of processors competing for a limited milk supply, is that sustainable?
Look, I think it's sustainable. It does sort of change the competitive dynamic somewhat for some processors.
I suppose I'm asking, Rowan, whether there are too many processors in the market.
Well, I think that's hard to answer exactly. Everybody will adapt their business. I think what we'd probably like to see is increase in milk production in Australia to support all of the processors. You know, there's great demand for dairy products locally and globally. It's a great industry, obviously, for Australia. And I guess, we're hoping that these higher farm gate prices encourage more to join the industry and be able to grow their business.
That was Rowan Davies, and he's General Manager of Dairy and Procurement at Buller Dairy Foods, announcing their opening milk price is a range of $9.40 to $10 per kilogram milk solids. And Rowan pretty clearly said there that expect increases at the supermarket shelf, whether that be Buller ice cream, whatever it may be, those prices are going to go up. Wondering whether you've already seen those prices go up. How much have they increased? Text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Now we're keeping you on your toes today. Usually you would be used to rural news at the start of the program. A little later today, but let's head off now to rural news with Jane McNaughton.
Good afternoon, Angus. We will start in New South Wales with the varroa mite outbreak. A new infested site has been found at Narrabri, 400 kilometres from the original affected hives in Newcastle. A new emergency zone has been formed around this region, which takes the total number of sites where varroa has been detected to 19. Despite this, the honeybee industry's peak body is confident the deadly parasite can still be eradicated. And Honeybee Industry Council CEO Danny LaFleur says the New South Wales lockdown could be lifted or eased by the end of this week.
So far, all our detections are directly connected back to the Newcastle area. We're still very confident that given that every detection we have has a direct link to either being part of the original detection or if there are some natural movement within the hot zone. So we have no reason to believe why we couldn't eradicate it at this stage. Every time we do find another site, as a result of tracing, we are finding many, many, many sites as a result of tracing that are not showing mites. The public are only hearing about the positive ones, but there's a lot of sites that have turned up negative through the tracing efforts.
You were hoping that the lockdown would be lifted towards the end of this week. Is that now looking unlikely?
We're still working on plans as we speak to have that lockdown either lifted or eased with a plan of movements very quickly after that, with the owner still being able to participate in pollination.
So potentially this week?
we're hoping towards the end of this week that we'll have a much clearer idea on what it's going to look like moving forward for beekeepers.
Dan Mapstone is a Narrabri beekeeper just 5 kilometres away from the emergency zone where the infected hive is. He says the local industry is on edge.
It's just devastating for the whole industry. Just having varroa anywhere in Australia is not good for us at all.
So how concerned are you at the moment?
Obviously it's a big concern. If we go into that red zone, we have to eradicate every one of our hives. So we'd be starting from scratch again. And that's a real letdown because, you know, we've come out of droughts and then we had the floods last year, which wiped out 25 of my production colonies. And then to have this on top of it it'll really hurt.
Still in New South Wales, the Commonwealth has activated funding support for local disaster declared government areas. Residents in more than 20 LGAs are eligible for assistance and dozens of evacuation orders are in place. Plus, more heavy rain and damaging winds are forecast for Sydney and the Hunter regions today. Emergency Management and Agriculture Minister Murray Watt toured the flooded regions yesterday. He says they are working with the states to battle the flooding disaster. The Australian government is seeking an update from Indonesia on its foot and mouth disease outbreak after it was reported that Bali now has 63 cows which have tested positive to the virus. A Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry spokeswoman said airport officers were operating with increased vigilance across all flights arriving from Indonesia. It comes from a push from veterinarians and the agriculture industry to beef up biosecurity from the popular tourist hotspot. There are fears some pineapple growers will leave the industry this year as the cost of production spirals and labour shortage bites. The chairman of Australian Pineapples, Sam Pike, says after a shortage of fruit caused by the weather, shoppers will soon again be able to enjoy an increased supply. But he says the future for farmers remains uncertain.
Industry's hurting at the moment, big time. Our cost of production's dramatically increased. We can't find staff. We can't get fertilisers. Things are really tough, and I'll be surprised if there's the amount of pineapple farmers here in 12 months' time. I really think that some might just call it quits. We're not getting nowhere near what we need for our product. You know, we're still getting the same prices that we were getting 15 years ago. And, you know, cost of production back then was about 60 cents a unit, but it's up around $1 now and we're barely breaking even.
And Turkish customs authorities have detained a Russian cargo ship carrying grain, which Ukraine says is stolen. The Russian flagged ship is currently at the entrance of Karushu port in Turkey. Ukraine wants the grain to be confiscated and Turkish authorities will decide the ship's fate. Ukraine has accused Russia of stealing grain from the territories that Russia forces have seized. And Angus, that's today's rural news.
Thanks for that, Jane. Jane McNaughton there with Rural News. On the text line, someone's texted in and they said, "Hey, Angus, if you could ask the weather gurus when," and then the text is cut off. So I'm not sure, but I'm going to assume the question was when it's going to rain again. But it would be great if you could finish off that text and just say where you are too, so I can say, put to the Weather Bureau coming up shortly, when the next rain is coming for that part of the world. But I don't think there's a whole lot on the forecast. But text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, as you would well know, the price of some staple vegetables has gone really through the roof at the supermarket shelf. But despite that, one of Australia's peak horticultural bodies says farmers are getting ripped off. Tyson Cattle from AusVeg says data that AusVeg collected before the recent supply chain disruptions showed farm inputs had increased by approximately 40%, but the supermarkets were averaging a 7.5% price rise. But for shoppers, Mr. Cattle says prices for items such as lettuce and broccoli are set to remain high for a while longer.
We're still seeing some supply start to come back onto the market from Queensland. Obviously, we rely on a lot of Queensland production at this time of year. So, you know, some of those guys are still, there's still parts of the Lockyer Valley and things where they actually haven't been able to get into their crops to plant their next crop. But certainly some parts of the region have been able to get back into their paddocks, which is a good sign. So it'll take some time for that supply to come back into the market, but it's certainly on its way.
It has been quite hard for consumers and some large companies such as KFC, but how's it actually looking for the farmers? We know there's high input costs at the moment, really high energy costs. Are farmers actually getting a fair price from the supermarkets?
Look, it's a really good question, Jane, and it's a really difficult one to answer at the moment. You would argue that the majority of our growers would say anecdotally that no, that they're not. And before the data that we've collected at AusVeg earlier this year shows before the supply issues that came out of Queensland, growers weren't getting rewarded for the higher prices in cost of production. So to put that in a bit of context, the average grower is actually seeing about a 35 to 45% increase in their cost of production. Yet, before some of the supply issues and the weather events up in Queensland, we actually saw only a 7.5% increase in the retail price. Now, you could argue, you know, where on the supply chain, who's bearing some of that cost, whether it's a retailers or whether it's someone in between or whether it's the grower. Certainly our feedback from our growers is that they are taking the hit. Certainly that we're in a unique situation at the moment because supply is low, given the issues in Queensland. But certainly we're continuing to monitor to make sure that growers are dealing with global issues, right, in terms of fertiliser costs, chemical costs, timber costs, wage costs, all of these different production issues that they're facing, a really challenging environment for our growers, and they need to make sure that they're being paid fairly, that and that they remain viable. I think that's been a real challenge, and we're continuing to monitor that space.
So there's been some experts looking into this as well. Independent reviewer of the Food and Grocery Code, Chris Lepsos, said he was watching the major supermarkets closely, but should the government be doing more, or people in these authoritative roles be doing more than just watching?
Yeah, certainly. It's a really good question. I mean, we've had a couple of conversations with Chris now around some of these issues. Certainly, whether it's a Food and Grocery Code of Conduct or whether it's a Horticulture Code of Conduct, certainly the industry, horticulture more broadly and fresh produce industry more broadly, has some challenges in terms of its own market price transparency. There isn't a lot of market price transparency in the sector, and that makes it really difficult in terms of getting a read of cost of production issues and farm gate pricing and all those sort of things. But certainly in terms of the code of conduct, I think from the Horticulture Code of Conduct and for the Food and Grocery Code, there's an element of it, they haven't been utilised in their current format. So the dispute resolution process for each of those codes haven't actually been utilised by growers or from buyers when it needed to be. Certainly we're looking at all of those avenues available to us through the independent arbiters and those sort of things at the moment. And obviously there's been a couple of changes to the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, which allows peak industry bodies, for example, to be able to represent some growers and utilise that process through the independent arbiters, which is a really good step in the right direction. However, we're currently reviewing our position in terms of those codes of conduct. If there are changes that need to be improved, I think one element is around the voluntary position of the Food and Grocery Code. But I mean, our first step in terms of some of these codes of conduct is actually making sure that we utilise the dispute resolution process that's currently available to us. And I think as an industry, we haven't made use of that just yet.
And staying in the supermarkets, I've seen some reports online of consumers trying to understandably save a little bit of money and snapping the stems off things like broccoli. Have you seen much of this?
Oh, look, we've seen the media reports. You know, obviously from our position, it's really disappointing. You know, obviously I think some of the retailers have come out really strongly that, you know, they consider it to be theft. I think that's a really good position from the retailers. I think at the end of the day, yes, cost of living issues and pressures are absolutely front of mind for a lot of consumers at the moment. However, you know, our growers are doing the best that they can to actually make it at an affordable price for consumers as well. And I think, you know, essentially ripping them off or ripping off the retailers is not helpful. And, you know, our expectation is that a customer should buy broccoli in its full form.
That was Tyson Cattle, AusVeg's National Affairs Manager, speaking with Jane McNaughton. On the text line, I had that text asking a question that had been cut off. Well, the text has followed up. They've confirmed. They're asking when it's going to rain next near Anuello in the northwest. And I'm assuming there's a lot of people looking for rain up there now, because Bob at Werrimal also asks, Angus, can you ask the weather person when will the far northwest get the next rain? I will hear from the Bureau in a couple of minutes and certainly put those questions to them. And another text from Marty, who says, regarding rain, farmers around Conniver always seem to be looking for more. So he thought perhaps that was where the mystery texter was from, but no, Anuello, not Conniver. But Marty says, good ground moisture levels around nil. can hear the crops growing today after a cracking frost this morning. Thanks for that, Marty. That text line 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
And it's just ticked over 12:30, so let's head off to news headlines today with Rio Davis.
G'day Angus, making news. Police have identified the person killed in a factory fire in Ballarat this morning as a 39-year-old man. Emergency services were called to the factory in Wenderee at about 6:30 this morning after reports of flames. Fire Rescue Victoria and Country Fire Authority Commander Malcolm Hayes says firefighters forced entry through a roller door and found the man dead, who's believed to have been living in a caravan inside the building. Police arson squad detectives and fire investigators will examine the scene today. The Real Estate Institute of Victoria says regional Victorian renters should brace for rent increases as landlords grapple with COVID-19 losses and increased land tax and interest rates. Median rent rates in regional Victoria have seen a 5% increase in the past year, and that's expected to worsen over the coming 6 to 12 months. Victoria's National Party leader Peter Walsh says he'll consider Australia's first truth-telling inquiry into abuses against Aboriginal people. The Uruk Justice Commission tabled its first interim report in State Parliament yesterday. Mr Walsh emphasised child protection issues, saying a recent Auditor General report had found the government had failed to improve outcomes. An elderly man has been taken to hospital after a car and a truck collided on a road in Western Victoria this morning. Six fire trucks attended the accident at the intersection of two major roads in Wallop after 8 o'clock, with the fire under control 20 minutes later. The man in his 70s suffered injuries to his head and back, while another man believed to be in his 40s was assessed but did not require treatment. And Aboriginal organisations and councils have marked the start of NAIDOC Week with events across regional Victoria. This year's theme is Get Up, Stand Up, Show Up, and celebrates the successes and survival of Aboriginal culture. For more regional news at any time, you can visit www.abc.net.au.
Thanks, Rio. Rio Davis there with news headlines. Better get off to the Weather Bureau now, where senior forecaster Chris Sarvia is on duty. Good afternoon, Chris.
G'day, how you going?
Pretty good, Chris, and we've racked up another frost, at least in the Wimmera. We've accumulated quite a few now.
Yeah, look, it was a pretty cold morning this morning, very frosty. Our coldest in the state was Wangaratta last night, -4.7 degrees there. We had also -4 at Rutherglen and -2 at Yarrawonga. But yeah, almost -5 at Wangaratta, the coldest morning there since 2017. So extremely cold out through the northeast last night. And that's sort of the trend. We're going to have another very cold night tonight and again on Wednesday night. So look, pretty chilly nights is the story over the next few days. For the remainder of today, look, pretty much clear skies across most of the state. There is a bit of patchy cloud hanging around in the south at the moment. And we're looking at cool sunshine across most areas, so generally getting to a top of 15 degrees. But, yeah, it's definitely been nice to see the sun come up after that very cold start. But tomorrow, overnight minimums generally getting down to around the -1, -2 mark inland. A degree or two warmer near the coast, but we're into a very cold night tonight. Likely to be a frost warning out shortly for most districts overnight tonight for some very, very cold conditions. But it will be followed by fine winter sunshine tomorrow after the sun comes up. And the morning fog clears, again, a top temperature around 15 degrees. But, yeah, very settled weather at the moment as this high is slowly moving across us. On Thursday, we're going to see a little bit of rainfall as a weakening front enters the southern part of the state. So we can expect some showers around southern Victoria, mainly Thursday afternoon and then throughout the day on Friday. So some shower conditions on the way, but we're not expecting anything in terms of significant rainfall totals with this next system. It's just going to be enough to wet the ground through the southern part of the state, but we won't see too much of that pushing far inland. But yeah, we'll be an end to the run of fine winter days by the time we get to that system on Thursday.
And that could be sort of five or six frosts in a row for some areas, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it has been a run of very cold mornings, that's for sure. And, I guess not particularly normal to get those cold mornings. That number in a row is pretty unusual. We will see those frosty conditions come to an end after this front comes through. At least for a time, it will introduce a bit more cloud, which will help the frosts back off for a little while. But they will return on Sunday by the time when we get the next high over us again. That tends to be the pattern at the moment. When we get those high-pressure systems, it allows clearer skies and those temperatures at the surface to really drop and start to see those frosts.
And, Chris, a long way out, but into the start of next week, possibly some rain on the horizon?
Yeah, so that's the one to watch out for, is a more significant cold front early next week. At this stage, the timing, still a bit of uncertainty around that, but looks like it'll be entering the state during the Monday afternoon or early Tuesday morning. And that one's likely to bring some shower activity for most of the states and possible thunderstorms as well. It looks like it will push up into the far northwest, so good news for communities out there. But in terms of actual numbers, probably not going to be enough to really write home about, but hopefully we'll see a decent sort of 5 to 10 millimetres for a lot of the state on Monday and Tuesday as that next system moves through. So that's sort of the next major rain-bearing system that comes across the state, apart from a bit of patchy drizzle about the coast on Thursday and Friday, but generally that's going to be less than 5 millimetres.
Okay, and I did have to ask about the far northwest because a couple of texters have asked the question of when the next rain should be expected for them, someone at Werrimal and another person at Anuello. So you're not willing to put a figure on what they might expect into Monday?
Yeah, it's pretty tricky to try and put firm numbers on it. It would be unlikely to see too much above 5 to 10 millimetres in the far northwest, but... on Monday, Tuesday is when we're going to see that next bit of rainfall come across. So hopefully that's at least somewhat going to wet the ground and be welcomed.
Rightio. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers.
Chris Arvia there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
A winemaking family in northwest Victoria has set out to prove that you can make top quality wine in a warm climate with very little rainfall nor irrigation. Chalmers Wines Australia has just released the first wines from its Bush Vine Block, a vineyard less than a hectare in size which has no trellis and only a handful of overhead sprinklers to mimic rainfall during extremely dry times. Kim Chalmers says establishing the vineyard in 2017 was a gamble, and since then, it's been a labour of love.
Back in the day, in Mildura, people were growing bush vine, Grenache and things like that, because that's just sort of what you did. But we've quite deliberately gone back to that style of cultivation, which is much more labour intensive and a lot less yield and things. But we're wanting to really push the envelope on how dry can a grapevine grow. So if you read the textbooks from Europe, they assume that you need at least 450 mils of rainfall per annum to sort of dry grow and productive vines and make wine. So as we know here in Mildura, our long-term annual average is 280. Most years we don't get to that. Maybe we did last year. And so we're well below textbook of what's possible. So we set up this vineyard with a very low planting density, so 2.5 metres by 2.5 metre vine spacing, so that's only 1,600 vines to the hectare. And we also have overhead sprinklers to mimic rainfall. So we're trying not to irrigate at all, but if we do need to give the vines a little drink, we give it an overhead irrigation so it's as if it's had a rain event.
You've picked two varieties of vines to put in here. What did you choose and why those varieties?
The first thing we wanted to do was choose the right rootstock. So we've picked 110 Richter rootstock, which has a very deep taproot. So given that these vines weren't going to be irrigated much, we needed them to go searching far and wide for water. So we chose 110 Richter as the rootstock. And then we went looking around Italy to try and find varieties that were at home in a low elevation, hot climate, low rainfall area, and that come from regions with sort of red sandy soils or red loamy soils. And we decided in the end upon Inzolia, which is from Western Sicily, and Negro Amaro, which is from Puglia, both of which have some history of cultivation as individual bush vines as well. So they're both very vigorous, as is the rootstock. So generally, if you've got a high vigour vine, it can survive with less water. There's a fairly direct relationship between drought tolerance and vigour. What we've found, which was just absolutely incredible, is that we're harvesting grapes off this block and making amazing quality wines with huge personality, absolutely beautiful wines. So the idea is, as these vines get older, we're going to keep pushing them a little bit harder and harder and see if we can get away without watering them at all, perhaps. But it's a very low input vineyard. We're not using any, you know, herbicides, or we haven't even applied any nutrition since we established the vineyard. It's all mechanically or hand weeded, and we're only doing one copper and sulfur spray a year. So it's very low input, and we couldn't be happier with the results so far.
I imagine that it's fairly labour intensive to look after, though, because you wouldn't be machine harvesting or pruning or any of those kind of things.
No, and of course they're very low vines, so you're bending over, and we're shoot thinning, we're bunch thinning, it's all hand picked, it's all hand pruned, of course, it's hand weeded. It's certainly a labour of love. When Bruce and Jenny purchased this piece of land, it had been an orange orchard that had been disused, and it hadn't been irrigated for years, at least 6 years, maybe more. And on this particular little rise here, there was still some citrus that was surviving even without irrigation, and you know, citrus are pretty thirsty. So we thought that that was a fairly good sign that this block of land might be good for this project. And my husband, Bart Van Olfen, who's our winemaker, he'd actually worked in Spain in Priorat with bush vines of Carignan, and he was just blown away with the quality from these vines. So we all sort of brought our bits of inspiration together with our sort of charmer's slant on Italian varieties, with our nerdy, you know, our viticultural hat on at trying to push the boundaries there, and then also, you know, making some great wine from the region. And the combination of all those things is coming together really well.
What do you think the Murray Valley region, and probably even further afield, can learn from something like this, especially when our region's going to get hotter and drier into the future?
I think what's really cool is to see that low input, low water requirement, hot climate varieties can make super premium wine. That's one really good thing, because often warm climates and warm climate wines are seen as being inferior to cooler climate wines because they're more alcoholic or too fruity or too full-bodied or whatnot. So I think being able to achieve that quality in a, you know, in a hot, dry situation is really important. Then looking at the low inputs, you know, and in a sense of sustainability is really exciting. You know, it's not going to change the whole face of inland wine growing, because of course not everyone's going to go and pay $50 or $60 for a bottle of wine. But what is amazing is when you use a test site like this or an icon site like this, and you realise that you can actually grow really great fruit at this low level of imports, then there's things that you can take away from that to apply to more conventional styles of viticulture. And I think it's really important that we don't just, I guess, throw our hands in the air and give up. We know that climate change is going to make marginal areas more marginal, and hot years are going to be more frequent, and, you know, all that sort of thing. We can't all just pack up and move to Tasmania. We do have to sort of work out what we can do here and not necessarily compromise on the end product. It doesn't mean, oh, well, our wines are going to become less attractive because of this. Let's find ways to make them more attractive and more sustainable at the same time.
That was Kim Chalmers from Chalmers Wines Australia speaking to Kelly Hollingworth. And there is more on that story up on the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural. 16 minutes to one, you're listening to The Country Hour with Angus Furley. And after 2 years of COVID cancellations, like so many things, the shearing and wool handling competition makes a return at the Australian Sheep and Wool Show in Bendigo next weekend. Shearing competitions are seen as important promotion for an industry, as we've discussed lots on The Country Hour, is crying out for more staff. Adrian Toohey, president of Northern Shears, which runs the competition at the show, says this year's event will also include qualifiers for the national titles.
As everyone's well aware, we've had no event for 2 years because of the COVID. And this one, this year, is a real eye-opener for people because it's going to be, you compete Saturday. If you win, you're in the state final Sunday.
Okay, so you could end up going straight through to qualify for the Nationals then?
That's correct, yeah, which will be held in Bendigo in October.
And if you do make it through to the Nationals, you're competing to represent Australia at the international competition?
Yeah, at the Worlds in Scotland in June of 2023.
And I suppose, Adrian, we should point out that it's not just a competition for shearers, it's also for wool handlers?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, wool handling is just as much important as shearing. And there's a lot of emphasis on wool handling at the present moment.
Adrian, you said there 2 years of no or little competition shearing and wool handling because of COVID. What's that meant, and how important are these competitions for, I suppose, promoting an industry that's crying out for workers?
Yeah, well, once again, there's a shortage of shed staff throughout the whole of the industry, and yeah, if by having a competition like what's going to be held at the Sheep and Wool Show, will showcase the best of what can be achieved, you know.
And I suppose in some quarters there is a little bit of a negative perception around the shearing industry. So are competitions like these important to dispel those perceptions?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
I guess we should probably also highlight that we're talking here about a shearing competition as compared to a speed shear, aren't we?
That's right, yeah. It's the quality of shearing the sheep right from the very first blow to the last blow. Not actually so much how quick you can get the wool off. Yeah, it's quality is the main thing.
Do you expect that there'll be people coming from all over Australia to compete?
Yeah, there will be. Yeah, there is people entered from New South Wales, South Australia, Tasmania, of course, a lot from Victoria.
Adrian, I think entries are still open, but they're about to close. So if you haven't got around to entering yet, what do you need to do?
Yeah, we go onto Sportsview Victoria's Facebook page and log on to the app there to enter. Pretty easy to do so, and all people welcome.
That was Adrian Toohey, president of Northern Shears, which runs the shearing and wool handling comp at the Australian Sheep and Wool Show. And those entries close tomorrow, so better get cracking. 13 minutes to one, you're listening to The Country Hour. And forestry groups in northeast Victoria are calling for more research to be done in the area of biological control of blackberries. Peter Crowe has worked in the forestry industry for 60 years and is chairman of the Softwoods Working Group and Murray Region Forestry Hub. And he says the problem is only getting worse.
I've been around for a long time, and when I first started in forestry at Batlow way back in 1959, there weren't any blackberries in the pine plantations at all. And you could pretty much walk around all the pine plantations totally unimpeded. That gradually changed, and I'd suggest that blackberries really got rocking in the 90s. About that time we started on pre-planting blackberry control, where the blackberries were quite dense and severe in their infestation.
I guess what kind of impact do blackberries have on then the pine industry and the timber industry? Like, what's the flow-on effect?
Well, the effect is that blackberries compete very severely and seriously with the young pine trees and even the older pine trees, because they compete for light, they compete for nutrients, and they compete for water. More to the point, the blackberries have become a real severe problem across all land tenures. And it's not just the farming and grazing land, it's also our national parks and water catchments. And we believe that we need to enlist as much support for a biological control mechanism to diminish the effect of the blackfish. We won't be able to eliminate them, but we would like to reduce them very severely, because the current method of spraying large tracts of country is just not practical, and it's not sustainable, it's not desirable, and the wider community would like to know that we're trying to minimise our chemical use, not increase it.
So is spraying the only way of controlling blackberries at the moment?
Back in the 80s, there was biological control tried using a series of rusts or fungi. They failed. They lasted a few seasons, but after a while, the rusts died right out. Biological controls were always thought to be a bit difficult because of the commonality of susceptibility with fruit like apples. And as we all know, plantations and orchards coexist in northeast Victoria and southwest New South Wales in areas like Stanley and Batlow and Tumbarumba. We think that we've got to do some more serious work on and well-funded work on researching biological control mechanisms. Well, the reason we've raised the matter, is because the forestry hubs have got the job of charting the course ahead of us, particularly in light of the fact that Australia's running out of wood and the whole world is running out of wood. And we want to make sure that the wood we are growing, first of all, is fit for purpose. And secondly, we're producing as efficiently as possible, not only from a production point of view, but from a cost point of view. So we are talking to anybody who's got anything to do with the business. But one thing we have learned, we need to get our local communities on side, our local politicians, and then go up to the next level. And we've already discussed this with the New South Wales Minister at the Softwoods Industry Advisory Group meeting last week, because we see that controlling blackberries is one way of increasing production and addressing the wood shortage that is with us right now.
That was Peter Crow from the Murray Region Forestry Hub speaking with Annie Brown. One more story before we get to markets. Landholders in the Burrumbuddock area north of Albury are playing a vital role in helping ensure the vulnerable squirrel gliders' long-term survival in the region. Part of the plan is to get landholders to plant tree corridors between private and public land to expand the squirrel gliders' habitat. Trevor Barber has a prime lamb and cropping farm at Walla Walla with his wife Marie. The couple have done historic revegetation work on their property, including planting tree corridors, and they were keen to be involved in the project supporting the vulnerable squirrel glider.
We're very proud of the work we've done for the environment, basically, yeah. We've actually managed to finish up connecting quite a few corridors on our farm now, and they weren't done there. Originally, they weren't done for the squirrel glider, but that's been one success.
What kind of trees have you got here that you've been using for corridors?
There's only four types of gum trees on our farm, like the yellow box, grey box, white box, and the Blakey's red gum, so that's been fairly important to sort of maintain them. But when we started doing it, we mainly planted, say, 70% gums and about 30% shrubs, but then the gum trees just dominate. So now we're finding it's really important to plant a lot more shrubs, a lot more wattles and hakeys and things like that.
When did you first start with the project?
6 years ago we had quite a few boxes put on our farm, which I was pretty sceptical to start, thought it was pretty stupid. But with a bit of time, it was quite exciting last year when for the first time we actually found squirrel gliders on our property, two in one box, and we've continued to see activity in the one particular part of the corridor.
So how do you feel when you know there's evidence that the squirrel gliders are using your corridor?
I got pretty excited the first time it happened, yes. So I said it was better than the really fantastic harvest we had, was a quote I made at the time. So, yeah, I'll stand by that one.
Is this something ongoing that you'll be part of?
Fortunately, it's something I'll put in place that will be ongoing, yes, because the corridors will be there forever. Our farm is getting sold in the future, but I'm very keen for the next landholders to sort of maintain the work we've done.
And for other landowners, farmers like yourself, what's your advice to looking out for endangered creatures and things you can do on your farm?
Let's face it, all farmers want to make as much money as possible. And we're pretty lucky because the two can coexist. It's not that hard. You don't lose that much land if you just have a corridor that probably needs to be 20 metres wide on the edge of a paddock. There's still plenty of cropping area. And let's face it, long term, the benefits of all the good work your bugs and insects and birds are going to do probably long term are going to be a benefit. But short term, you're probably not going to see any financial gain. But I'd thoroughly recommend farmers. The more they do, the better, because it really is wonderful. It's a win-win for everybody.
That was Walla Walla farmer Trevor Barber speaking with ABC reporter Alison Jess. Off to the markets now, starting today at Ballarat Lambs with Shiona Lamb.
Good afternoon, Angus. Lamb supply remains similar with 14,800 yarded. Quality runs of medium and heavy trade and export heavy lambs, but not as much weight offered this week. Quality slipped in the light trade and store lambs, ranging from plain to good. Not all the usual buying group attended, with one major exporter absent. Light trade lambs sold to 10 cheaper, mostly due to quality. Medium and heavy trade were mostly firm to a few dollars softer. Heavy export sold to a top of $281 a head. 26 to 30 kilo lambs sold to $4 dearer, and over 30 kilos sold to $7 a head cheaper. Store buyers were quieter this week. Quality was an issue, selling from $28 to $166 a head to be $12 cheaper in places. Lambs to the trade, 18 to 22, sold 156 to 192, 22 to 24 kilo lambs sold 184 to 204, and 24 to 26 kilos sold 202 to 229, with an average range of 810 to 840 cents a kilo carcass weight. Export force caught 26 to 30 kilo lambs sold 220 to 253 to average 829, with some sales in the high eights. This is Shiona Lamb at Ballarat for MLA.
Thanks, Shiona. And now let's head to Wodonga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Oh, good afternoon. 888 cattle were offered to the usual winter buying group. Quality remains very mixed, with very few cattle suitable for the trade. Competition fluctuated, with processors very selective. Secondary cattle suitable for lot feeding sold to patchy demand, resulting in a cheaper trend. A few veal, $5 to $5.80. Trade steers gained 27 on account of the improved quality, $4.90 to $5.80. Medium weight feeder steers slipped back 10 cents, $4.62 to $5.60. Trade heifers slipped 40, $4.50 to $5.40. Trade heifers medium weight were back 20 cents, $4.40 to $4.70. Heavy steers to the processors gained 4, $4.30 to $5.30. Bullocks $3.90 to $4.40. Cows jumped 12 cents, $3.48 to $3.69. The middle run, $2.66 to $3.42. And the better shaped bulls, $3.12 to $3.32. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne, and apologies we can't bring you the shepherd and cattle report today, but we'll be back into the swing of things tomorrow.
Nominations for your Australian of the Year
are now open.
It's time to reflect on your community
and who you admire.
It's time to show your respect
by nominating
and acknowledging them.
And it's time to celebrate
their story,
their contribution
and their generosity.
I'm Hamish McDonald, and I'd love you to nominate an inspirational Australian that you think is worthy at australianoftheyear.org.au.
Well, we're almost out of time for today's Country Hour, but before I go, Jeff from Jam Jarup on the text line says, why aren't you focused on foot and mouth disease on the Country Hour? If it gets into Australia, it will cause total devastation. There is no time to waste, and tourism to Bali should be suspended. Didn't talk about it today at length, Jeff, but we certainly did yesterday. And speaking of that outbreak in Bali, There is an excellent article up on the ABC Rural website with the latest details, so go to abc.net.au/rural. And hey, make sure you tune into the Country Hour tomorrow. I'm heading out to the Longrenong to the Wimmera Machinery Field Days event. It's not their main field day. That was cancelled because of COVID. But they're running a scale-back version, I guess, with some local machinery dealers bringing some of their latest and greatest machines and technology along. So I'm going to head out there and broadcast live from the site. So make sure you tune in. Same hours, 5 past 12 to 1 o'clock. Hear about the latest and greatest in machinery innovation. Remember as well, there is the Facebook page. Go to ABC Rural on Facebook.